Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
So, I have to tell you, I'm straight up unhappy today. So, I'm unhappy. Yeah. So, the unhappy music is for me today. Joining me from Kansas is Will Costantini. Will, good morning. How are you?
Good, Mac. Hey, I'm getting a news show in the back. I don't know if that's just me or if it's coming through you.
Yeah, I don't know how that's being fed to you, but I was musing about that last week, but I'm not sure
now
why.
Now it's on.
Got it.
Yeah,
we're
good.
The, Tim Lynch joins me from McAllen, Texas. Tim, did Hurricane Laura miss you, get you tangentially? Any repercussions?
No. It's way too far north from us, and we're not even getting some cover from the sun. It's just 107 degrees, and the sun is beating down.
Congratulations. And thanks. Joining us, he was doubtful, but he pulled a cat out of the hat or a bird out of the hat. I don't know. Jeff Kenny joins us. Jeff, how are you?
Good, Mac. I'm good. I'm down here in Coronado helping Colonel Bob Coates, retired, teach R2P2.
Explain to everybody what R2P2 is.
R2P2 stands for Rapid Response Planning. I don't know what the other P is. It escapes me now.
But, I think it's process.
Right. So, planning process. Exactly. So, anyway, you should be teaching this, not me.
No, I don't like that. I don't like that. It's too complicated.
Anyways, we're doing it. We got a bunch of guys who just met each other on Monday, really, when we started this thing. And they're going to be going out to Kuwait to do what we used to have Muse do, but now we use these MagTAFs to do it. So they're doing pretty good. They're a lot of experience. A guy who's the CO used to work for Will and First LAR. He's a very solid citizen. He's got a good three, good intel people, good ops, and so they're all coming together pretty quick. It's pretty enjoyable instructional period.
Well, let me fuck your day up.
Good.
Yeah. Headline: NCIS ATF investigating sailor on the USS Bonhomme Richard for arson. Have obviously Tim hadn't seen that. Thoughts, William?
Yeah, I had no idea. Totally surprised by that. Completely unexpected. By me, but maybe it helps explain just how big that thing got. No idea. Crazy, though. Absolutely crazy.
Timmy, thoughts?
I am alarmed. I'd be very interested to see what was motivating this particular young man, and I would hate to think it had something to do with all this problems we're having in the cities this summer, But boy, oh boy, that's a shocker. I've seen guys who didn't like the crews that they were assigned to in the Navy, but I've never heard of anybody launching a major conflagration like that, which puts the lives of everybody on that ship in jeopardy. That's crazy.
I'll read you another response from another friend of mine. Dear Lord, are you kidding me? I mean, so that's the level of, right, aghast, that guys who aren't normally taken aback, their reaction to this story. Jeff, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, when we first got down here Monday, Colonel Coates, we went around. He knows all these guys in LFTC, or what used to be LFTC, now EWTG, down here. And we talked to him about, and he said to all of them, because their windows look out on where the BHR was moored. And he's like, what'd you guys think seeing the Bonnie Dick on fire? And they're like, oh, geez. None of them mentioned anything like that. So it is a shock, Mac, because those are the type of guys who would have heard, if it wasn't a total surprise. You know what I mean? Because they're like, we can't figure it out. What's the Navy coming to? They conjured up the Forrestal. They conjured up, ships that were, badly damaged in the Second World War, carriers and stuff that they salvaged at sea. And it is a shock. Like I said, I didn't hear an inkling of that from these guys. And this is where all rumors begin, you know, the Navy bases down here in San Diego. So that is a shock.
Well, that's where the story emanated from, which was was Channel 10 in San Diego, and I'm sure they got somebody that tipped them off. But both Navy officials and DOD officials confirmed that NCIS is investigating a sailor for possible arson charges, which
that's
is
just awful, man. It's just awful.
Yeah, you know, to me, I said a little bit ago, but the social experiment that has been the United States Navy, I think the sun has set on that shit. I think it's time for the Navy. Yeah, I think it's time for the Navy to embrace discipline and a more difficult path, and to do so in a public way. And so the people that want to join the Navy for GI Bill benefits and a soft route and not so harsh conditions, they need to stay out of the fucking Navy, because you need different people in the Navy, because this is, on top of everything else, I mean, good God. I mean, good God.
So many years of that type of shit, Mac. It's going to be hard to turn that one around.
Well, but you have
You're right. It needs to be.
There is no other way. Tim, Will, any other thoughts before I give you the next little piece of poison?
I have to say this again. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Will.
I was just going to say, I don't disagree with your sentiment, but I don't want to tie it to this guy yet. He's an individual that acted, and there should be accountability. And it may point to a greater rot in the system, but I'm not going to draw a straight line between those two yet. I don't disagree with your sentiment, but that's based on all kinds of other things.
Right. Well, no. Let me tell you, my sentiment is not based on this incident. This is now the latest cherry on top of a whole string of cherries. Right.
And there you go. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I'm right. Absolutely with you.
Right. There's like a straw on top of this sundae, or like a wooden skewer that's going into the sundae, and this is like the ninth cherry on top of the sundae. And so to me, if you need more proof that the Navy needs to be fundamentally reformed, then you need to be punched in the face. Tim?
I need that.
Well, Let us assume, hopefully, that this individual, if he is in fact charged, is not of Islamic heritage or of African American heritage, acting out on either one of those two pathways, because that would be a problem. But let's just pray he's just a disturbed young white kid. The problems stemming from the Navy, and I say this so much, I'm gonna have to stop saying it, stems back to post Tailhook, when they forced upon all of us the fiction that there is fundamentally no difference between a woman and a man. Each is capable of doing the other job. There's no difference. That's strictly a social construct, not a biological fact. And so that's the great lie that we service. And so if you proceed from that point forward, you're going to have problems. And I fix on that because I know the friction that's generated with the male female stuff. And I don't think the Navy can be taken seriously until they get back to the business of fighting ships, and reducing the amount of friction in the crew would require, in my humble opinion, to segregate them by the sexes.
And yeah, I think the problem relative to leadership is way broader than that issue. And you may – we could point to say, yeah, Tailhook was the beginning of all that social change. But, you know, again, you know, those social changes, if you hold true to the standards, like the Marine Corps was told, oh, we're not going to change the standards, then you don't have an issue. But that's a lie. Anybody who tells you relative to this shit that we're not changing the standards, right, is a liar. The guy who changed them in the Marine Corps was Jason Boehm, right? Now we don't – everything isn't great at IOC. Well, shit. Three of the four of us taught there, and Will supported the son of a bitch all the time. There was never a time when you weren't evaluated at IOC. Now, three of the nine hikes are evaluated. Are you shitting me?
Yeah.
Right? And that's under the guise of, no, look, we're not going to change the standards. Bullshit. And so to me, I think the problem is more fundamental than simply women are involved. If there's women there, and there are some unicorns out there, and they can meet the standards, and they can do the work – right? Then they ought to be in the United States. I don't know how you prohibit that. Right? Now, the good order and discipline argument, that sailed a long time ago. But the problem is that thing becomes an entryway for the whole performance curve to be allowed to slide. And if we don't recognize that, and that's where the Navy is today.
So, well, it's more than the Navy, the military in general. To get ahead, you're being forced to pretend that things that aren't true are true. And the women thing is just one of them. There's a whole series of things we all got to pretend, you know, and they will dictate to you, that this is now true. And this, and if you don't parrot the line, you get fired.
Well, and let me just tell you, I brought this up a week ago or so, you know, but you drive on to any base and look at the way they look. And so to me, this slide, you know, is the most visible things are, you know, women and standard things. But just look at the way it, you know, Cam Pendleton looks. It looks like shit. Yeah. And we talked about this 2 weeks ago. You know, and it's a big joke, right? Rake sand, painted rocks, you know, the ropes on the red stakes. That was how you took care of your Quonset hut, right? Yeah. And if you watch an old episode of Gomer Pyle, you will see it in spades, man.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how we did it, because that was our statement about us. It looks like shit now. And so,
yeah, and they're fighting it. And like, for instance, Horno looks like a ghetto. But if you go to fucking Mateo, they're fighting. They're trying to get it. It didn't look bad. I mean, I was in 150 area, in that area where the memorial thing is. They're working it. But it's a struggle. And, you know, every CO is always got this thing over him now. That we've always had the command climate thing for the last 10 years. But now it hangs over their head like Damocles' sword. You know, and I think you're definitely right when you say, we got a big problem across the board.
But, Jeff, what happened to field day on Thursday and cleaning up our shit? Well, we don't really field day like that anymore. It's just kind of a general cleanup. Does anybody inspect it?
Well, yeah, I mean, formations. Now they just have texts. They text everybody. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, so to me, and that's – you see this broader issue of discipline, and our culture's changed. And our military's changing, and let me tell you, you're now hitting to a point where how many billion dollars was a Bon Homme Richard?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, just recently refurbished to take the F-35, which means it's a bigger deal than it used to be, as you have these essentially Jeep carriers with F-35s on them rolling around the Pacific that got to be accounted for. It's not like that Harrier thing. And so that thing just got burned by somebody on purpose? Are you fucking kidding me? So anyway, not that I'm fired up about it, but I kind of am.
So what's the other good piece of news?
Well, the Marine Corps today announced that, and I want to let Will comment on this because he has a solution for this. But Will, I want you to thread the needle on this, with which is the way it will happen, not the way it should happen, okay? And that is, Marine Corps has said that there will no longer be pictures submitted with promotion packages or command packages or things like that.
I'd be a fucking general now.
hey, don't kid yourself. The so Will, tell us about the, if we wanted to make it a blind selection process, is that possible? But that can't be, because there may be unintended consequences that the services would not accept. So it's this masquerade of, yeah, we won't consider that you're ugly as long as you can PT and you're within height and weight standards. So we'll explain this to us.
Yeah, so when you go to a board, how it works is there's, you know, 15 people that sit in the board, and the people in the board get a certain number of cases that they got to brief. And the case is your complete record, your digital record, and your picture. And so you take a Marine's career and you break it down to a six-minute brief. And what happens is you flip the picture of the guy or the girl or whoever up on the screen, and everyone looks at the picture while you're doing the brief. The picture, by Marine Corps order, is only supposed to ensure that you're within height weight standards. You know, interesting, though, any modern psychologist will tell you that you look at someone's picture and you form an impression immediately. So my thought many years ago was we should eliminate all identifying characteristics from the file to include pictures, names, and even reference to sex. And that would eliminate, you know, 90 something percent of any sort of perception bias, that could be in there. And so taking the picture out is a good step. You know, now, and also all of these boards, the statutory boards, i.e. for promotion, are required to brief out their ethnic, racial, and by sex standards. For example, 10 women were in the promotion zone for colonel, 5 got promoted, they're at 50%, versus the board promoted 61%. And you just got to report out those raw stats. And they do it for, I don't know, Asia Pacific Islander, Black, Hispanic, whatever. Race, ethnicity of the person. And you're going to report out the stats. And now organizations are going to be pushing for the stats. But are they going to be happy with the results that they get? We'll see how long this sticks. You know, we will see how long it sticks. It's a step in the right direction. It's not the complete step, but it's a step in the right direction.
All right. But again, the problem for the services is if you go completely blind, you have these demographic goals that you want to reach, whether they be gender or race. And if you go completely blind, you may not get to those. You may go in the wrong direction. So the trick is to appear to be blind, but still be conscious of all those affirmative action goals, if you will.
Well, either that or you step up and you be a man and you just let the chips fall where they may.
Oh, that ain't going to happen.
And we're
good one.
Yeah, I know.
Where's the rim shot when I need it?
Yeah, you know, it's a step in the right direction. If the motive for
a famous
it, for
man,
it is
yeah,
aligned
a famous
the,
man told me, if you want a dream to come true, you got to have a dream. You know, that we actually evaluate based on the record as it's written and presented in the room, as opposed to any other outside pressure. It may be a pipe dream.
Yeah, you know, I don't believe it.
It may be a nightmare for certain people. But
I don't believe the motive is a step. If the motive is aligned with the reason for the step in the right direction, then it is a step in the right direction. But if the motive is tawdry, which I suspect it is, then it doesn't help, you know?
You know, in the first, 27 minutes of this thing, Kenny has used the word tawdry, and he's also used the word, he used another one, the sword of Damocles. How about that?
The sword of Damocles, yeah. Well, I looked at myself in the mirror, and tawdry came to my mind, because I'm just not a good civilian dresser.
But here's a, this is, this.
I've oftentimes had a figurative sort of Damocles hanging over my head. So, matter of fact, it's like a comforting hat I wear now.
I know.
But, I'm kind of touched that way.
All right. Here's the rim shot that goes with Will's about 3 minutes ago. Any other comments about that? I mean, honestly, the news, the Bonhomme-Richard news to me, I saw that. And it's like, you know, I mean, we're all used to, you know, I mean, look, the fact that they couldn't put a fire out on a United States naval warship sitting pier side, right, for what, 4 to 5 days or something like that? I mean, was in and of itself, depressing. We can't do damage control on a ship that's designed to contain damage. We can't do that. And there's a lot of reasons for that shit. So it's like, and then you read that, it's like, oh, you know, like you were on the ground rolling around with that gut punch I gave you, right? How about a 2x4 to your teeth? So anyway, I want to talk about Gene Sludge, though. I was kind of doing some research on him, and I ran across these 90 minutes of an interview that Studs Terkel did with him. As Studs Terkel prepared to write the book The Good War. And it's interesting to hear Turkle interact with Sledge. And so I listened to it, and I was like, I was like a Twitter, if you will. And because it was just this getting to listen to a guy like Gene Sledge in long format for 90 minutes was close to 90 minutes was pretty cool. So let me get your general thoughts, and then we'll start talking about some of the things we heard. And I also sent these guys the link to his papers that are at Auburn University. And I sent them to Duffy White and Dave High, both friends of ours, but they are Southern type people. And Duffy expressed great lament over the fact that they were at Auburn and not Alabama. And I said, well, Duff, I know this is going to be hard to swallow, but when a man like Gene Sledge deliberately sends his paper to Auburn, I'm not sure how you root for Alabama there, bro. He took that hard. He took that hard. I'm going to tell you that right now. So Timmy, start with you. Your thoughts listening to Gene Sledge in long format.
Boy, did I enjoy that. That was phenomenal. And I thought I lived in a bird area. Turns out I live where there's birds. I like how he said that. It validates your approach to with All Marine Radio, these long format interviews, because they're damn fascinating. And he even got Eugene Sledge driving and talking in the car. So they were way ahead of the comics and cars thing by about 20 friggin' years. There's lots of specifics that I really enjoyed listening to. But how would you like to have a 70mm Mountain Hauser being shot at you like a rifle?
Yeah,
and oh my God! I mean that kind of stuff was unbelievable. As was the story of Bill Ledin, who was hit by that damn thing and flew up in the air and never got a VA disability rating to reflect the traumatic the TBI, which was appalling to hear. Something that wouldn't happen now. But the one thing that stuck with me, particularly when I read some of those letters you recommended, was his fierce pride to the unit. I had no, you know, I read his book and I had pictured him as a professor with a kind of a nice, easygoing, a gentlemanly type of Southern university professor, which is exactly what he sounds like.
Right.
Until you start poking around with his unit and talking about whether they did or did not get their due as the histories were written, and his fierce regard for his unit totally impressed me. And I said, yeah, that guy, that he's got it. That's a Marine. I loved listening to every bit of it.
All right, Jeff, your thoughts, Gene Sledge. And yeah, you were in 3-5. Were you Kilo Company?
Originally. Yeah. Yeah. And then I went to Stapleton, which was H&S Company as the platoon sergeant.
Yeah. Kilo Company's call sign is Sledgehammer.
Right.
That's awesome.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that book, I don't know if it came out in 1979, but, you know, I read it as soon as I saw it in the stores, you know, and it affected me. It's a great book, and he's a very reflective guy. And that's the thing that jumped out at me listening to those interviews is with Turkle. Instead of Turkle, I'm not really a big fan of his usually, but he did a pretty good job doing that. He's kind of a pinko smartass.
Right, know? Right. Well, I mean, he's this, like, bon vivant, right, Chicago guy who writes, but he writes about pedestrian perspective on life. But
he's like, he tried to be the Jimmy Breslin of Chicago.
Yeah, and he was, regardless of Jeff's sentiment about him. But
I didn't like Jimmy Breslin.
their interaction, though, is funny, right? This Chicago bon vivant guy, and here's Sledge, this very different human being. But they both connect in this intellectual way, trying to articulate that which Sled has seen, and the whole I did not get that the whole The Good War title was a play on words, right? I did not. Yeah, I haven't read the book, but I didn't get that. And you do get that from.
I saw the book come out years ago, and I didn't get it either. But let me tell you one thing that jumped out at me in these interviews that hadn't really jumped out at me before about Sledge, his profound sentiment about the war was the sustained fear, and that sometimes reach the, you know, the point of terror. Other times it's annoying type fear of what's coming, but fear, constant fear. And then he got angry at the fact that he was facing that fear, and he resented the fear. And when he left the Marine Corps and he got back home, and he searched for other answers to that type of fear. And so he read widely, not just prose, but poetry too about that stuff. And they go through the whole world, and he found it, or partially found it, in World War One poems and writings. But also, and this is really interesting, because I read this book years ago, a book by Paul Fussell. I can't remember the title of it, but the guy Fussell was a company grade infantry officer in the Italian campaign in World War II. And he was positive. I mean, it was the fighting in Italy was brutal for those guys. You know, one cross compartment danger after another, from basically, you know, the Naples area all the way up to to Milan. And so he was positive that he was going to be turned around and remissioned to invade Japan, and he knew he wasn't going to make it. And he had that same gnawing fear thing that Sledge had. But what's interesting to me about Sledge is he resented it, and then he got pissed at it. And I think that anger comes through in the latter part of his book, you know, his experience, especially when he first got home. He was still angry that he had been put in a situation where he was terrified for such a sustained amount of time in, Peleliu and then in Okinawa.
Will?
Yeah, I think two things just broad-based about the interview. Sledge is exactly as you expect if you've read the book. Yeah. You know, he wrote it late in life after he'd been a professor, but it wasn't professorial, but it was very straightforward. Turkle, comes across as clueless.
Clueless?
As clueless. He's read the draft of the book, I'm pretty sure. He may have even read the book. And I'm not just talking Marine Corps nomenclature type of stuff. He just was – I was just really unimpressed with his part of it. And then the other thing that's interesting about Sledge, you know, I wrote it down. It's not an exact quote. He says, "Few people know what it's really like to look at the enemy through rifle sights." And Sledge – very strongly makes a distinction between the front and the war. And there's a big difference between the front and the war. And that's a lesson for leaders. Leaders today, are we basing training, recruiting, doctrine on the front or on the war? Were you in combat because you rode convoys on the MSR? Or were you in combat because you were the first, second, or third guy that went through the door? And Sledge reminds us there's a huge difference. And he resents people that write about the war and think that they were writing about the front. It really... If you read his book, he tells you things about the front that people that write about the war never saw, didn't know, and didn't write about. So that comes through, I thought, very strongly in that interview repeatedly. He brings that up.
You know, he makes a comment about he read something about the Iwo Jima campaign being
glorious.
Yeah, something written, you know, after the war about the glorious amphibious campaign of Iwo Jima. And, you know, in that southern slow drawl, what was glorious about it? And, in his perspective, to me, there's so much. One thing that jumped out at me, there's a series of pages of notes that Sledge, I think they're his outline for the book, or at least just some of his. It's under in his papers. It's entitled WTOB, which is With the Old Breed Notes on White Pages. So it's his. They're just pencil notes, and so one of the things that I've seen more than once in his notes and different things are never led anybody anywhere. And it's interesting that he says that about himself, that he never aspired to be a leader, that it was he and Snafu Shelton that were right, and it's like they're the odd couple, right? Snafu Shelton is this, and in the series Pacific, they make him into this exotic figure of a Marine, right? He's the street educated, you know,
New Orleans
guy that's it's got that weird Louisiana thing going by the way he talks and the different things he says. And he's really, I think, one of the most compelling characters in the whole series, Pacific. But they form this this crazy tandem of Sledge So Cerebral and Snafu Shelton So Guttural. But Sledge also talks about their training and how important the training was that got them ready to go fight the Japanese. And he goes through night fighting. He goes through, you know, knife fighting at night and the fatigue. The other thing that strikes me throughout all of it is his tremendous compassion and his level of observation throughout. And I'll give you just an anecdote about this. His observation. He talks about it's funny. He talks about field stripping the Japanese, which included going through all their shit and sometimes relieving them of their teeth. And then he kind of, as an aside, he says, you know, or as we used to say, right, by the appropriate dental procedures, right, which meant the tail end of a K-bar, right, smashing out gold teeth that the Japanese has. And then he kind of chuckles. So it gives you some kind of, like, insult, like, ee. But his compassion and his level of observation is such as they're going through these papers, he says, you know, you would always see these Japanese who fought, and he doesn't respect the way they fought. He said they fought in such a barbaric way and the way they treated civilians, but they would have these portraits taken and there would be flowers arranged there. And he had deep kind of observations about them culturally and then would contrast them with the way they fought. And then in his papers, there's a letter that is written to him by the mother of her name is Mrs. William Derby, and she includes a picture of her son who was killed on Peleliu. She wrote and he was in the 7th Marine Regiment. Sledge is obviously in the 5th. She writes a letter to Leatherneck magazine asking for information from people that served on Peleliu so that she might better understand. And Sledge writes her. And so to me, he has this incredible compassion as a human being that comes through and his humility in the interview. And you read this in his papers and you think this guy took the time to write somebody's mother who he didn't know from Adam, who wasn't in his regiment, because he felt that kind of responsibility and had that sense of goodness in him. And I just to me it's pretty impressive. And the humility piece of it are when he and Studs Terkel is like flipping the cassette tape or something, and Terkel saying, "This is really great stuff. You know, this kind of right. That's kind of what I wanted. You know, you just musing and then Sledge says, "Don't let me go on now." And Terkel says, "This is wonderful stuff." And he says, "Don't be fun of me," or he says something like that. He said, "Because I don't want to be doing that." And yet it's just in long format. I thought it was great. So, with all that said, Timmy, another observation about it or about his papers?
Well, Studs got him to start talking about how he wrote the book, and it turns out that he had two grandfathers in the Civil War, one of whom they had extensive papers from, and the other they had nothing. He had just disappeared casually in the war. They know nothing about him. And he figured he's in part of a big endeavor that he's going to start recording things so he could write an accounting of this for his family at least. And he starts recording these incidents in his pieces of paper that he shoves inside of a Bible. And I found that to be a pretty fascinating. The other thing that he disgorges is where he is identical to the four of us, in that he tells Studs that he had read extensively about history, but he had never read anything in literature that talked about the experience of the man on the ground doing the fighting. Because obviously This is long before you started having stuff like On War and other, you know, John. Oh shoot, I'm blanking on the name, but at any rate, other authors who had wrote on that. And so essentially what he wanted to know was, what was it like to touch the elephant, using the old Civil War term for experiencing combat? And subsequent to then, as he becomes an academic, you notice all the guys he refers to when they're talking about who he reads, they're all of them first World War guys who were in the infantry and had touched the elephant. Bertrand Russell, Robert Graves, Wilfred Owens. These are all heavy guys that had legit combat time. And it seemed to me that he had a very strong bias towards reading guys that he felt were legit in the same way he was. It's the same thing that I think that the four of us do today.
Yeah.
I said that to him. But, yeah, like Sassoon, he tells an interesting story I never knew. About Siegfried Sassoon, gets decorated for heroism in the trenches. He comes back to England. He starts saying, "Hey, we got to stop this thing. It's ridiculous," and he's surprised the guy doesn't get, you know, court-martialed or any kind of, you know, any kind of disciplinary action. It's because another poet said this guy has, you know, the equivalent of I can't remember what they call it, neuralgia or something like that. The Brits. Term for being combat fatigue. So Sassoon goes back. He goes back to the front. He goes back to the shit he tried to stop, and he gets wounded badly again. But that, and after that is when most of his great poems came out. And but yeah, he was on a search for that thing, like Timmy's saying, the actual experience of you know, kill or be killed stuff.
Right. Well, any other observations relative to his papers or relative to the interview?
Yeah, he wrote a letter to, I wrote his name, McCain. I think he was a lieutenant colonel, but I could be wrong. But it's in one of the letters, and he told him some advice that he got from his father, and I think he talked about it in the interview as well. And it's the basis of post-traumatic winning. His father told him, "Don't feel sorry for yourself. Life isn't fair." And be sparing in your use of alcohol. And
Wait a minute. I didn't read that. Hold on. I didn't read that. What letter? Was it in McCain?
I think it was McCain. Yeah. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Life isn't fair. And be sparing in your use of alcohol. And
relative term.
But, and it's something because Sledge's father knew that from treating, as he says, World War One shell shock, or being familiar with World War One shell shock.
Yeah, I remember that.
I.e. PTSD guys. And, you know, how many times are we going to learn this lesson? Right? That was sort of profound to me when I read that. I would say one other thing about the whole thing. You know, obviously the Marine Corps was very different in World War II. And this is something that we have to deal with in the modern world. We're a professional force. You know, they were not. It's a different war they were in as well. And so Sledge talks about, guys prying gold teeth out of Japanese skulls, sometimes while they were still alive.
Yep.
And we court-martial people for pissing on dead bodies. And a lot of people were up in arms about that. But it's a different expectation. It's a different war. It's a different time. And how do you train and understand that nuance? And I'm not saying one's right, wrong, or indifferent. I'm just saying it's something that you've got to think about as you organize, train, and equip the force, and as you lead the force. I want people to learn a lot from Sledge, but also understand the things that Sledge and Marines and Kilo 3-5 and all those Marines in World War II, that's a different time and place. And how do you translate what you want from that warrior ethos, that brotherhood, that loyalty to unit, and how do you bring that out in a different war, in a different time, in a different place? And Sledge can't answer, but he can help pose a question.
Yeah, that's a big problem we got right now. I mean, because to go back to your early point, Will, you know, about the thing about now we prosecute people, you know, for abuses that don't come close to some of the things they did as routine in World War II, i.e., like you mentioned, the mouth pissers there of, those Marine snipers. But the truth is this, and that now here's the ugly, ugly truth. It's easy to say, well, we've matured as a society and we don't put up with that anymore. But the events in our big cities now show that that's not the case, because we have legal people. We have district attorneys who are ignoring the same type of abuses, similar abuses that we get Marines court-martialed for in Afghanistan and Iraq, i.e. looting, burning, assault, and sometimes murder. And pretty much, if you're on the right side, they ignore it. So we've become a nation much more cynical, and it's reflected in our military forces. The very fact that somebody, you know, could set fire to one of our primary warships, you know, and the fact that and the things that came before it, all the other things that we've been talking about for the last 2 years, you know, that's happened with ships running into each other and hitting other ships and stuff like that. That's just the Navy part. But the truth is this, you know, that we're in a society that picks and chooses what laws it's going to enforce. And that's not good.
Well, and let me give you another cherry on top of that. And you know what is the primary driver in all that? Video.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't get on video, it doesn't break squelch. Right. Yeah. And it could be terrible. But it's the power of your video. And if your video isn't powerful, then, you know, we're not really going to be bothered by it. And so, you know, so I don't know how the American public would have reacted in World War II if somebody would have been videotaping a Marine smashing gold teeth out of the head of a Japanese soldier that was paralyzed from the neck down. I'm not sure. I mean, they reacted, you know, to the, you know, the they didn't release the footage of Tarawa, and they limited, you know, footage of Iwo Jima because of the casualties, and they didn't know how the American after the Tarawa thing, you know, and people were calling for General Smith's, you know, resignation. Like, who is this butcher Marine general? Like, what the fuck? But in the currency of the realm today is video. And if your video is powerful, then it doesn't matter. And that's what happened in Afghanistan. And I remember when sitting through, you know, General Amos came around and wire brushed everybody and whatnot. Sitting through, like, I wonder if these, you know, now I know there was political reasons and all that, but my sentiment was, has nobody read the With the Old Breed? I mean, it's not like this is an anomaly in our wars, let alone a prolonged war. And I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying that, you know, these things do happen. There are anomalies in our core. Right. But why are we here today? Because of the video and the exposure of the video. That's why we're here. That's why we're doing this. This is all eyewash, you know, for the commandant. And I will say, though, as much as it irritated me to sit through that, I understand the eyewash piece of it. And I'll liken it to why the fuck in Wisconsin in the information war, right, that was a piece of in terms of the commandant and the pissing on bodies and stuff. Why did it take 3 days in Wisconsin to get information out that they knew within minutes of an event happening, let alone hours? And you have a riot going on there, other people getting killed. Do you think that maybe if they would have had a press conference and say, look, here's what we know. This guy is a repeat offender, blah, 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 blah. We got a call that summoned the police here. Right, they attempted to subdue him. He resisted. They attempted to tase him. He continued to resist. It did not work. He then made his way to his car. He leaned into his car, and there was a knife on the floorboard of the car. He was then shot. That is what we know now. Why the fuck did it take 3 days to get that information out into the public realm? I don't get it.
Well, hold on a second. How long did it take to get the full videotape of that that incident in Minneapolis out?
George Floyd, yeah.
Yeah, because that's a whole different incident now when you watch the whole tape.
I don't get if you don't think you're in an information war as a city, as a municipality, and you can wait and sit on this shit till it's convenient for the DA, till every I think you're stupid. You're stupid.
Well, there you go.
I would say to go back to the Afghanistan thing and how it maybe echoes with things that happen in different war. Again, that's the challenge of leadership right there. Understanding that there are anomalies. How many anomalies can you let go by without coming out and hitting people with a 2x4? To make sure that these anomalies do not describe the force. Because, you know, as General Mattis used to say, keep your honor clean. You do that for the organization, but you also do it for yourself.
You do it for yourself. You do it for yourself first. I'm convinced of that.
Might have meant, when they say keep your honor clean, when Mac says keep your honor clean, he means it. But a lot of times these guys, and I hate to say it, but a lot of generals we talk about, when they say keep your honor clean, what they really mean is don't embarrass me.
Yeah, when I say it, I say you got to put your pillow down, your head on your pillow for the rest of your motherfucking life. And if you don't keep your honor clean, I don't care if you're on liberty and somebody gets killed and hit by a car late at night when you're drunk, which I've heard a Marine talk about, or a helicopter crash, which I experienced, a helicopter flying 7 feet off the fucking deck in training or in combat. And I play this. In fact, I was just messing with it yesterday. This video of this guy named Barnado Simpson and he participated in the My Lai massacre, and he ultimately kills himself 28 years later because he can't live with himself anymore. You keep your honor clean for you primarily. The institution is a collateral beneficiary of that.
Yeah, I was up there in the front office when this was going on, and I won't betray any confidences, but I would say. Some very senior people up there, part of their job is to guard the institution.
Yes.
But part of their job is to guard individual Marines as well. And that doesn't describe the entire leadership that's up there. Absolutely. Some people look at it through the lens of the institution, period. But I think that there was a lot of deep thought about, primarily young men that we bring in and ensuring that we return them as better people back to society and not allowing people like the corpsman did with Sledge when Sledge was going to pry the gold teeth out, said, you don't want to do that. There is a certain father-son relationship, even from the top, that can't always be felt. But there were leaders at that level in those offices that were trying to make sure that we did not, turn the force into barbarians. And that's how they thought. And you can't agree or disagree with the methodology. But I think that was a significant part of the motivation at that time.
Got it. All right. Anybody else on that? Wow.
I put a guy in the Marine Corps that had a conviction for manslaughter from drunken driving. It actually was his roommate. He was a ROTC student when it happened. And fast forward to Salt Lake City, and Timmy needs a dep and ship in February. He's going to miss mission. And this guy had been trying to get wavered. And we wavered him in because we had a good CO then. And he ultimately served 20 years, came out as a major. But his entire life was defined by that one reckless incident that it happened in college, and it derailed him. And he was able to recover because we gave him a chance because we needed a shipper in February and we didn't have anything else to do but give him a chance, and it worked out. And that's the other half side of the coin is Sledge's dad is so right about staying away from the liquor. But when you get together with the old mates and whatnot, there's a certain relaxation that comes when you're pounding a few beers and sitting around and bullshit. And it's a very narrow path to walk correctly. And I liked it in the previous iteration of the Marine Corps when we were a little bit more lenient and would waiver guys in that had made a mistake and would send a guy home to sleep it off if he hadn't done anything wrong. I like that approach better.
Yeah. No, it's interesting when you hear Sledge. I'll tell you another interesting thing. And Jack Riley knew Gene Sledge, right? They're Alabama. Wow. They're Alabama guys, right? And Jack told me, he said, you know what? One of the things Sledge asked me, he said, after we met, and he looked at me, he said, have you spoken to your wife about your time in Vietnam? And Jack said, no, I have not. And Gene Sledge, if I remember it correctly, said, you need to do that at some point. And so, you know, here's a guy who was doing, I mean, both of them practicing, you know, some of the things we talk about in post-traumatic winning, you know, and getting pieces, as Will said, from his father. And you're seeing these guys who live great lives, and they're doing it. And it's interesting that Jack, you know, that Jack relays that. To me, Sledge is his intelligence and his great humility comes through in everything you read about that guy. I mean, and then you hear it in his voice. You know, yep. And I love that about, you know, and then I as Timmy's talked about that letter, when he gets pissed because he helps this guy write something, I don't know if it was about Iwo Jima or something, and the guy says that he wouldn't identify Kilo 3-5 when he spoke about Sledge because it wasn't this type of thing that was going to name units. And then he names other units in the thing. And Sledge gets fucking pissed. Yeah. And he says, this guy wants me to come to Quantico to do this narration. And if they won't allow me to say I'm a Kilo 3-5 guy, I will never, ever again participate in anything. And he's pissed. And he writes that to his buddies, Merrill, Snafu, Shelton, and a couple other guys in a very cool letter. But reading that, it gives you in my opinion, deeper insights into him and the things that he took time in his life to do. And I thought it was interesting when he said he wanted to, at one point he was debating whether to be a cancer researcher, and he decided right. against that because he liked
the outdoors.
Yeah, he liked being outdoors. And so he got into ornithology and the teaching of that kind of stuff. And then the other thing, when you get an idea about his intellect, and he kind of compares the miracle of life, right, and the fear that he experienced. And he said, you know, life is a miracle. And he said, you can have all the ingredients of life, and you could put it together. He said, but you, and again, all that time in that southern draw, but you don't have life. Life is a miracle. And here we are, you know, trying to kill each other.
Savagely
trying to kill each other over some stupid ridgeline for 10 days. And he talks about the horror, which I think is reminiscent of World War I when he says, look, there were dead Japanese all over the place. We threw dirt on them. It rained. So there were maggots in the mud. And then our dead were there, and we tried to get them out as quick as we can, but sometimes we couldn't. And he said you would slip and fall, and your hand would go in the mud, and you'd be covered in maggots and somebody's shit. And and they portray that in the Pacific pretty well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you just get this sense of his immense intellect, his immense humility, his constant intellectual study. As Jeff said, going back to poetry of World War I and different books, I think Fussell's book, the first one I remember seeing was Wartime, which is, I believe, his second book. Right. I think his first book is something about the war. I think it's called The Great War and Modern Memory by Paul Fussell, published in 1975. Wartime came out in 1989. But yeah. Anyway.
He said, is the worm that never dies is a phrase I remember from one of – I don't remember which book I read, Mac, by Fussell, but the worm that never dies is what Sledge references, and that constant fear he felt for all those months in Peleliu and then in Okinawa. And that Fussell talks – he calls it a gnawing worm, you know, the worm that never – keeps gnawing at your insides because those guys are in and sustained – I mean, I don't know how many days sustained Fussell was up there in Italy without even a break, you know. But, you know, it was, and those guys, people don't know this, but parts of Vietnam, I think maybe even a majority of guys who went to Vietnam didn't really have the level of adversity that a lot of those Army and Marine grunts had up in the I Corps area in those rice paddies. Constant, 100, 140, 180 days straight in the field, being shot at sometimes, and sometimes, especially up there in the northern part of I Corps, you basically had peer on peer warfare with heavy arty and shit, very much like Okinawa, and then you read, Marlantis's book about the shitty supply and how they're starving up there sometimes. So it's like, that's the thing that they both, the adversity and the gnawing, knowledge that, any time they could go.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and that is how does the Marine Corps define warfare? Yeah. Is it Okinawa? Is it Chosin Reservoir? Or is it security at Camp Takata? And how you define the war should be how you define the force. Yeah. We're not defining the war to define the force to set the standards based on the front.
No, because it would. I mean, think about it. Well, and I had Carl Marlantis say this to me. I sound like a well-traveled, well-versed human being when I say this kind of shit. I had Carl Marlantis say that to me in one of our conversations. So, I mean, think about Carl Marlantis's war, northern part of I Corps, humping up and down mountains, making contact, calling in artillery and napalm strikes to denude, right, the jungle so you could see the fuckers, right, and then napalming them and closing with them and killing them. And that was humping down, up and down, mountains to do that. Zinni talks about in Combat Concepts things he got pissed about after he left the basic school and went to Vietnam. He said the first thing was, and he puts his hand over his face, jungle fighting. He says, I didn't know shit about jungle fighting. He said, and the next thing was, we were doing 20-foot contour lines here at Quantico. They were doing 20-meter contour lines in Vietnam. So I'd look at a map, and I'd have something in my head, and I'd go see it. And he said, that thing's a mountain, for God's sakes. And so, but that mountainous terrain is what Carl Marlantis fought in. And to get to Will's point about when you decide which version of something is war, then you begin to tailor the requirements. And Marlantis said, I don't know how a woman could do it. Even women who are great athletes. First of all, you're out in the bush and you're kind of sort of starving to death. What you're eating is in no way, shape, or form replacing what you're losing, and your body's getting smaller. Your thighs are getting thicker. Your back's getting bigger, but your body's essentially shrinking. He said, I don't know women that could do that. And he said, then you're going up and down mountains carrying, a heavy load because you have to in terms of ammunition and food. And then you got to close with the enemy. He said, I don't know how. And so Marlana said, I don't know how you have a woman who could do that. And he said, look, I didn't know a lot of average men that could do it. So
exactly.
if you define it as firm base operations and IED patrols, then it's a completely other set of standards. And that other set of standards line up completely with people's social agenda in the Marine Corps today. And I think it's very interesting. If you want to go and you want to say, okay, what happens in peer-to-peer war? Let's go back to I Corps in Vietnam. And if you're a politician, you'd quickly look at that and say, yeah, we can't use this example. Because I can see where this is going.
And I got something to add to that. It's a tangent. But it's regarding training, where Eugene Sledge mentioned that he felt their training was more than adequate. It had to be a little bit tough.
Well, superior, because he shits on the Army.
He does shits on the Army. But listen to this quote I pulled out of Neptune's Inferno from our boy Hornfisher. This is the Rear Admiral Randall James in 1942 lamenting the recruits. Here's the quote. The nation has passed through an era of soft living and rampant individualism that resulted in a staggering rate of rejection among new recruits for physical shortcomings. That was in 1942. Can you imagine?
Well, I mean, what it is, it's a, you know, we talk about hearts and minds in Vietnam and almost derisively, you know, the idea of trying to get it. But what's being waged now, you know, in Western society, at least, particularly the United States, is a war for the hearts and minds of the protected, overnourished, overindulged observer on television. That is what they're all doing. So if it sounds bad, they don't like it. So it sounds bad to say women, you know, they watch shows. They saw Laura Craft do a back somersault and kick ass on four big dudes, you know. They know the truth. You know, and when they hear people say things like what we're saying and what, you know, General Barrow would say, they don't like it, so they vote against it with their ratings and stuff. And that's why we're in this shit right now, because it's there's not enough vigor in the counter side, because they're the guys who actually do stuff. General Barrow goes and makes a great speech to Congress, and every one of those congressmen is thinking two things. Number one, never have this guy in front of us again.
Right.
And number two, you know, how am I going to – we have to reject this, because if you look at the math, there's 51% of the population are women and 49% are men. And, you know, and there's a lot of different reasons why people vote one way or another. And most of them don't have to do with either success, you know, in tactical level combat or with the truth.
Right. And so if you're a politician, you know, General Barrow seems like a wonderful man. But get his ass out of here, man. We do not need that, because that is not helping me get reelected. And that is a single criteria that I base everything I do on.
And it's a horrible thing, Mac, because we believe in our hearts, all four of us, if we just tell the truth and we do it in a convincing way, we'll change these good people to believe what we think. But I don't believe that anymore. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I feel that, but I don't believe it intellectually anymore. And when enough people who are like us don't believe it intellectually anymore, you got problems.
Oh, no. No, let me tell you again. What is that famous saying? The truth is the first casualty?
Yeah.
And I was talking about that today, you know, relative to – there's a guy named Jason Whitlock, and he took on LeBron James, called LeBron James a racist over the stuff that he said. And Whitlock, I mean, he's a black guy. And he said, look, man, LeBron James, he says he's afraid. He's not afraid. You know, I mean, that's a lie. And all he's doing is doing this, using the same tactics, you know, that the Ku Klux Klan used to demonize a group because of the actions of a few. He said, that's race baiting. He said, we're supposed to be beyond that and better than that. And he makes, I mean, he goes on and there's nothing that he says that is not true. But I think what we're looking for is, where are the adults in this conversation? When are they going to show up, right? And I'm talking about adults that are leaders. When are they going to fucking show up and do what they're supposed to do in this country? And the answer is, they're not. And it's genuinely disturbing. So how does this get better? How do you sit on those facts and watch your city catch on fire three nights in a row, right? Two people shot and murdered. Maybe if you tell the truth, because that is supposed to be important in this democracy, you get it out there expeditiously and maybe head off these riots, maybe that shit doesn't happen.
Yeah. What's the greatest book on leadership ever written?
Well, according to you, it's the science fiction Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers, Robert Heinlein predicted all of these things. And you know how the society evolved? Because you've read the book. Some veterans in Scotland got sick of it and started hanging rioters and looters.
I agree with that.
Robert Heinlein, it's the greatest leadership book. He predicted all of this, and he wrote the book in 1959.
He said
back in the XX century, so he thought it would happen by now. He said a bunch of veterans banded together and got sick of it and started hanging people.
Well, there's damn few problems, I believe, that can't be solved by a good hanging or a good masturbation session. But, you know, I don't know if we'll be able to publicize either. But I'm for both, especially the hanging
one. How do you go from Damocles' sword to a masturbation session all in one, you know, like 75-minute segment.
Have somebody set off 2155 rounds 2 feet away from you. And then drink a lot.
You know what? Hey,
don't drink during your recovery. I think that's drink during your recovery.
I think you've used that crutch far too many times, okay?
You know what? I'll tell you something. You're right. I have. But I don't use it as an excuse. I use it as a sales technique to allow myself to continue to drink, which I do. Although less than I used to. I'm ashamed of myself for the lack of volume.
Otherwise known as Jeff's Visa card, right? He just swipes that son of a bitch, and he gets out of all kinds of trouble. Oh, you know, he's a wounded, disabled veteran. Oh, he is? I didn't know that. Yeah, he got blown up a couple times. So, oh, okay. Yeah, that's why he says that crazy shit.
Well, you guys know me before. I said stupid shit like that before. Yeah.
We know.
Yeah.
All right, what are you reading?
I got an excuse now.
You know? I know. Well, trust us. Will, what are you reading?
So I read two books. I finished Common Sense Nation. I told people about it. I read a book this week that I tell you everyone needs to read, pure and simple. It's called Being Mortal by a guy named Atul Gawande, Gawande, Being Mortal. It's about end of life. This guy is a surgeon. And he gets into things like assisted living and hospice, and it's profound. And it isn't post-traumatic winning. There's a little rhyme in there, though, about how to make choices and live the best life that you can. And I've actually called people that are close to me and told them that they need to read this book because we're all going to deal with it. So I read that, and then I just started a book this morning that I think is going to be great. It just came out. It's called A Quiet Cadence. A Quiet Cadence.
Bullshit.
By a guy named Mark Trainer. T-R-E-I-N-O-R.
Shut up. Shut up, Will.
Who was that? Oh,
what?
Mac.
I interviewed the son of a bitch yesterday.
Yeah.
Are you joking?
I missed that.
You what a dumbass.
No. I bought it on Kindle last week, and I just started reading it. It's great. Have you read it?
How contrived it isn't.
Here, I thought you were just a shallow, attention-seeking jackass, and now I find out you're just a jackass.
I'm sorry. I didn't listen to the show yesterday. It's a great book.
That's better, Will. That's better that way.
It is.
That shows that, yeah, you know, that. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I'll tell you what. It's a bit like, first of all, listen to the interview because he's an interesting guy. And again, it's interesting because it's the horizontal themes of post-traumatic winning come out in his book. And mm-hmm. and he talks about, he said, look, I'm no, at one point in the interview, he says, I'm no psychiatrist or anything, but I think you're much better off talking to another veteran.
Yes.
And I said, I'm a psychiatrist, self-proclaimed, and I'm telling you that you're absolutely fucking right. He said, "What?" I said, "You don't know this about me, but," and then the book skews towards right the he's from Vermont, goes to Naval Academy, you know, is impressed by Marine leaders like many you know have been while they're at the Naval Academy and. You know, goes to basic school while he's there. It's like, hey, the grunts are the place to be, and winds up in Bravo 1-5, not Charlie Company 1-5, but Bravo 1-5 in Vietnam, west of Da Nang, fighting in the Arizona Territory against the VC, doing a lot of counter IED and booby trap shit, and ambushing and night patrolling and stuff like that. And then he comes back and he lives with it. Forever, and he's a successful guy. He's a lawyer and whatnot. And but the story is his, you know, factual based fiction that Marlanis used in Matterhorn that allows him more literary license, and he thinks to develop points better. But his story is very interesting, along with the book. And then he has some interesting takes because he did some work for the government in terms of evaluations in Iraq and things like that, was in Iraq in 2007. And I asked him, so what was it like to see us, you know, do Vietnam a second time? And he went, ugh. So, come on, Will. You got to listen to the program. What the fuck? Seriously?
All right, yeah, now I'm looking at the podcast. I see it.
Yeah.
I bought it like 2 weeks ago. I just started it today. It's a great book. It's a great book. I'm in chapter 4 out of about 40. But it,
well, that was
really
a spontaneous
good.
Plug for that book, if there ever was one.
So well, and great. As you said, Jeff, it's the best kind of plug, which is unsolicited and absolutely sincere, which is a word we don't use with Will very much. cynical, yes.
We're all fucking sincere.
Cynical, yes. Jaded, absolutely. Sincere, maybe not so much. That's just me.
Hey, it's what it takes to win at poker, Mac.
Exactly. It's better than stealing people's retirements at the poker table, though. God bless you, Will, for staying away from that. Although Will doesn't see it like that, Timmy. Timmy does.
I would say just go back. Being mortal, well worth everyone's time.
Got it. All right. Tim, what are you reading?
I started fall semester this week, so I'm slowing down. I'm still on Neptune's Inferno, but I got to tell you, Will walked into that one just like that your interview trainer walked into the post-traumatic winning yesterday. I was listening to it this morning, and he walks right into that not knowing that you've got a thing or two to say about that, just like Will did just now plugging that book. That was funny, man.
Could you see it coming,
good
though?
Radio. That's good radio, though, bro.
Oh, could you see it coming, though? He's Mark Trainer. He's a great guy, and he walks in straight into post-traumatic winning. That has no idea what's coming. It's like a mousetrap I spring on his head.
It was good, man. It was a good interview.
So Tim's back at school. All right. We love that. Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, actually, I got the book that Vito recommended about the Holocaust, and I have Will's Hornpiper – or not Will – Tim's Hornpiper thing. I haven't started either of my.
Okay, hold on. It's Hornfisher, you dumb fuck. It's that Artie injury, right?
No, yeah. That one's just fucking bad thinking. But anyways,
Hornfisher the younger. I still can't get over the fact he's like 20 years younger than us.
Hornpiper, for God's sakes.
He has a silly name, and he should be resigned to the fact that people are going to fuck it up, and especially me.
It's
a silly name like Snodgrass or Hornpiper.
It deserves to be fucked up, and it's your fault.
Yeah, we used to have a general named Snoddy, and he changed his name from Snoddy to Snowden. Like this is like 76, 77, but everybody still called him Snoddy. You know, but so when you have a fucked up name, just embrace it and realize that.
You know what? And I completely agree. I was over helping my ex-wife, Susan, move her furniture, and her landlord comes over. He's a Polish guy. And
right. So
I just made up a name for the guy. I said, hey, Thomas. And like after I'd called him Thomas three times, he said, my name is Edward. I said, no, it's not. No, it's not. It's Thomas now, okay? Once I call you Thomas three times, you are Thomas. And he says, okay. And so my daughters and my ex-wife are looking at me like, you're the biggest asshole in the world, man. Call the guy by his name. And my daughter's like, Dad, don't call him Thomas. I'm like, no, this is guy shit. You guys don't know what the fuck you're talking about. He's Thomas. So then I went out of my way every time I addressed him to call him Thomas. Hey, Thomas, could you hand me that screwdriver? And he's like, sure. And I said, look.
You know, it's just the way we are, man. Every time I had a guy – who would report into work for me named Richards. I always name him Dick. Dick Richards. I got that from IOC.
Right, you have to.
So there's, that's their name now. And everybody remembers. Sir, thanks. Everybody calls me Dick. Even my mom calls me Dick Richards.
Hold on. Here's an email. Who is Vito? Vito is Will.
Oh, that's Will, obviously. I'm obviously. That up.
Yeah. Jeff started talking.
I just reverted back
to mafia name.
Monica.
Yeah, that is another nickname for Will Constantini. Constant Weenie was another one. That was meritoriously earned, though. And then Vito was his kind of call sign, his nickname among us. And so when we call him Will, that we're having like to be polite because that's not how we would normally talk about him. But all right. Anything else, Jeff, that you're reading?
No, that's it. I've done enough damage today, I think.
No. You have been like, you have done like Stewart's ride around McClellan, man, with all your with your masturbate.
They call him Foopaw Kenny. Who knows?
And he didn't admit to any felonies on the air. So.
That was pretty epic. Although Timmy had a greater chance. You got Tim so excited, and then he lost his mind, and he admitted to an actual possible felony, for Christ's sake. And you just were in the misdemeanor category, so hopefully the statute of limitations is beyond on both of
that.
That's
what I live by.
And I'll tell you what, and I that had other incidents like you, I just sat here and didn't say a fucking word, man. I'm like, I'm not going down that hole these idiots are. So anyway, I'm reading nothing. And Will, I owe you three links because I just completed like the third hour of post-traumatic winning, and it's kind of interesting. I'm doing this video as I begin to kind of, you know, ramp up starting to do videos for it. But as I'm unencumbered by time and I can kind of do what I would like to do with each segment, I'm probably about halfway through it, and it's 3 hours long already. And so, Will, I will send you the three links to it, and you can let me know what you think. But I will tell you this: it's really amazing. I had the opportunity last week to spend time with Marines from the 15th MU and BLT-14, and to the conversations I had with them, with first sergeants, with individual Marines. The more I do this, the more convinced I am. There is a single path that if you want to go down the path of endurance, the path of medication, be it self-medication or prescription drugs from the VA, and you want to try to endure this shit, you are on a path that you roll the dice with your life with, that there is a better way, that there's great men from our culture that have gone down this road. We know them as guys who were at the Hanoi Hilton. There's other people that you can hear it in their life echo, and that is Gene Sledge, Jack Riley. These guys have gone down this path, and they have a message for you. And not only can you live a good life, you can live a great life. And last week was a great experience for me, and it keeps unfolding in front of me. I tell that story about Stacy Falzerano, whose husband had a massive heart attack. He's a colonel in the Space Force. But I talk about Stacy. I said, look, I would tell everybody, you could take all of our brains, grind them up together, and stuff them in one skull, and she still has more brain power than all of us, okay? She's like a brainiac. And in her time of need, what did she reach for? Who did she reach for? She reached for the traumatic wisdom of the enlisted Marine Corps. That's the power of this shit. That's the truth of it. And that's why I love it so much, because I love our culture. I love our fuck you culture, our, you know, got a chip on your shoulder culture. And I love that it embraces the truth. And so doing this is a labor of love for me. And so I'll send you the links, Will. And like I said, last week, here's a funny story. Well, I think I told you guys, but you guys all know Trent Gibson. I'm standing outside the regimental instruction facility, which used to be the gym at Camp Horno, getting ready to do this. Chris Bronzy standing next to me. And Chris is a great friend and a battle buddy times two. And I get a text message from my son, whose company's being evaluated during a movement to contact. And he says, hey, Dad, guess who's my evaluator? I'm like, I have no idea. He says, think IOC. I said, bud, you're painting with a fairly broad brush there. And he says, Trent Gibson. And I went, you got to be kidding me. And so I show it to Chris Bronzy, who's friends with Trent. They were both instructors under Major Kenny, right, at IOC. And Chris looks at it and laughs and says, holy shit, your son better not be fucked up because Gibby doesn't mess around. And so I relayed that to my son. I said, hey, just so you're not having too good a time with one of my friends, he'll put a dagger in your heart if your shit's fucked up. And John said, I know, I'm actually kind of nervous about it. But throughout that whole experience last week, It was very humbling for me to think that, you know, that after going on 2 years of doing it, that it has a reputation, that it's what Marines need to hear. And what they need to hear with certainty from people like us is there is a path that you can walk. And Timmy's gone down that path, and Will's, you know, gone down that path, and Jeff's gone down that path, and I've gone down that path. They need to hear from credible people from their culture that they believe, you know, that there is a path that you could go to. It is no bullshit, and you can live a great life after this shit happens to you. And so it was incredible. It was incredible. And so again, I hope this thing keeps getting bigger and there's more work but I just want to publicly thank you guys, because in very separate ways these guys have all contributed to post-traumatic winning. And whether it be thoughts, Will and I had a conversation about 3 weeks ago about, you know, tragic or trauma, and is there a time, you know, is there a time element involved in all this? And I mean, all these things, they make me think, and then they resonate in these presentations. Somebody asked me last week, like, well, Mac, do you think this is too soon to talk about things like this with guys that have gone through it? And I thought for a second, and I reflected, and I said, well, the best mental health advice I ever got, I got it from my company, Gunny, 3 hours after I had seen somebody decapitated and, you know, three other guys died, two of which we were trying to save. And I said, so I don't know that timing makes a difference. I think quality advice is quality advice whenever you get it, and that's my experience in my life. And so they were like, wow, that makes sense. And I think it makes sense because it comes from people that have this experience, not from people that are giving you advice that have never lived it. And so I just want to publicly recognize these guys for the contributions that they've made. Their honesty, you know, to me, you know, shit, to me, one day starts talking about being homeless. And I'm texting people like, did you know Tim was homeless? And they're like, fuck no. Is he okay? I'm like, well, he is now, but he never told us. And they're like, but again, that takes no small amount of courage, no small amount of balls to talk about, you know, that which you struggle with. And these guys have all been great about it. So.
Yeah, well, I was an excellent homeless guy, though. I was fucking awesome homeless, dude.
I was at the high end of that pool. So, no. Anyway. All right, guys. First of all, appreciate the time, as always. And the discussion about Gene Sledge, because I think that, you know, I hear and read guys like him and Jack Riley, and they inspire me to be, you know, a better version of the Marine that I've always thought that I am. But I see those guys and I think, yeah, I can be better if I'm more like them. And so I appreciate your comments and your doing your homework on that stuff very much.
Well, he made my day with those kind words, Mac. Thanks.
No. I mean, let me tell you, it's, you know, it's one thing to talk theoretical. It's another thing to talk about yourself, right? And what's really interesting, and let me tell you how this stuff continues to echo. You know, Stacy Falzerano is getting her household goods moved in this week, right? She lost her husband in May. She has five kids ranging in age from 2 years to 25 years. She's now on board with helping, you know, write and do some other production stuff, which is pretty cool. My twice roommate from IOC who told me he's been sexually assaulted twice in his life, once in college after he was drugged, and once in Oceanside as an enlisted Marine, wants to come on to talk about that experience because of all that he's heard and the way it's changed his life. And so this is the most incredible thing I've ever been a part of or ever seen in my life. And I haven't led an unincredible life. I've seen a lot of courage and selflessness and a lot of incredible things in 3 years of what I did in Iraq and Afghanistan, and being able to watch the bravest, most selfless people in the world, and that are Lance Corporals, PFCs, Corporals, Sergeants, Lieutenants of Marines, and watch them get after it every fucking day, not when it was convenient. And so I've been able to live, I think, a pretty incredible life. And it gets more amazing by the day as this truth that we talked about earlier and our fidelity to it begets the salvation of other people, if that makes sense. Takes them to this place that's pretty incredible. So So, and your guys' contributions to it on a regular basis are huge. You know, and I will tell you this. I mean, Jeff is constantly putting me in touch with different people that have an interest in this. And so it's pretty cool to be able to do this with these guys that I've known for, what now, 30 years? Fuck, yep. Man. That's brutal. That's brutal. That's brutal. On that depressing note, we will put a bullet in this. So thanks for the visit, guys. Always appreciate it.
Thank you, Mac.
Yep. There you have it. Yep. From Kansas, Will Costantini. From Texas, Tim Lynch. And from Southern California today, Jeff Kenney. The Mensa brothers here on Jeff Kenney. You just saw his intellectual dexterity, right? The Sword of Damocles to getting drunk and masturbation all in one 90-minute episode. Yeah, let me tell you, you're not going to find that kind of intellectual. Is that intellectual? You're not going to find that kind of intellectual range anyplace. So with that said, we're out of here. If you're just tuning in hour one, I talk about Jason Whitlock. He takes on LeBron James, calls him a bigot. Talk about that. And I commend him because I think that the nation's waiting for the adults to come out so we can have an honest conversation about race, about the police, about inner city poverty, and finding a solution, finding a better way, because the shit that's gone on isn't working. And the bullshit that you're seeing that substitutes for honest debate and the truth will take the nation nowhere. I want to know why it takes 3 days to report the facts in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that there's an information war that exists, and until law enforcement people and mayors and cities, they get that memo, you're going to see cities burn for days until we find out, you know, the makings of the truth. And sometimes that truth's going to maybe mitigate. Sometimes it's going to make it worse. But the truth's got to get out there quicker. And I will tell you, this is a horrible, horrible story. And you heard it in the voices of Will, of Tim, and Jeff. And that is the story about arson being investigated as a cause of the fire on the USS Bonhomme Richard. Again, a friend of mine sent me a text that said this: "Dear Lord, are you kidding me?" And so that's a more profound, how do I say, that's a more profound word. Those are profound words from somebody, you know, when they're discussing news that tend to be pretty direct. And that's how, that's how taken aback I think my friends are with that story. That it's not anything that anybody ever contemplated, right? That racism might be the cause of that. And how does that impact your view of the United States Navy and the maladies that afflict the United States Navy? So talk about that. But it's an unbelievably terrible story. So if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. You'll hear all of that jam-packed into one exciting radio program. Yeah, All Marine Radio. So I think where you come for the truth. And let me tell you, if you're looking for inspiration in a number of different ways, the people that you hear here, and you just heard three of them, I think will inspire you. In spite of their callousness and they're people that truly do give a shit about their country. They've served it. They give a shit about their communities and they want to see them become better. And so if you're looking for an honest conversation, and you might not always like it, but I don't think any of us give a shit. Like I said, we've been doing this for 30 years. Yeah, pretty amazing. And we've been not giving a shit about each other's opinion for 30 years. and making each other think and making each other go back to the drawing board and listening to each other and comparing footnotes, going back to the drawing board and all that. So a better way, I think, a better way. So more of that in hour one. And then if you're just tuning into this, pretty interesting discussion about the Bon Homme Richard, about the Marine Corps eliminating photographs for promotion, and the dance, the delicate dance that they walk as they try to thread that needle to say, yeah, we won't look at pictures, but we do need to hit certain quotas. And then three, the we talked about the interviews that Stud Terkel did with Gene Sledge, and also I sent them the link to Gene Sledge's digital archives, and we talked about stuff like that. So pretty interesting little hour and a half. So have a great day on a Tuesday, All Marine Radio. No, it's not. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio. Out. Oh, yeah, don't be afraid to change somebody's life. I don't want to say that's an implied mission, just your friendly public service announcement. Don't be afraid. Out.